From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. One of the central issues in the U.S. presidential campaign this year has been trade and trade agreements. One of those agreements, the so-called TTIP pact with European countries, has apparently failed. RT's Marina Deshashi has more.
The German vice chancellor says the free trade talks between the U.S. and Europe have failed.
The negotiations with the United States have de facto failed, even though nobody really admits that. They held 14 rounds of talks based on 27 chapters, but not a single agreement was made on any chapter. The United States wants to write the rules, but we should not submit to their proposals. We Europeans have our own way of living.
Sigmar Gabriel believes the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, is designed to benefit the U.S. at Europe's cost. It has been viewed as a legacy-making project for President Obama. However, there has been much controversy and disagreement over the deal. According to TTIP negotiation drafts leaked in May, European laws on climate control, energy saving, and environmental protection could be changed to accommodate Washington's demands over the controversial agreement. The leaked document suggests the U.S. could scrap EU rules on food labeling to mask the presence of questionable chemicals. Consumer protection will be slashed across Europe. American genetically modified products and pesticides would enter EU markets. All that would mean a direct and dramatic reversal of the Union's environmental policies.
The role of the U.S. media in fomenting war by the United States against Syria has come under examination in an article claiming that the goal of U.S. media coverage of the war on Syria is to prepare the American people for a war by the U.S. on that country. Journalist and founding member of the Syrian Solidarity Movement, Rick Sterling, spoke with RT America's Manila Chan.
A great example is regarding Aleppo. If one follows PBS NewsHour and CNN and those stations, you would never have a clue that 85 to 90% of the population of Aleppo is in part of the city controlled by the Syrian government. All we hear about are victims in the parts of the city that are controlled by the rebel terrorists. Meanwhile, there are Hell Cannon missiles being fired from the rebel terrorist zones into the government-held areas all the time, dozens and hundreds every day, with lots of injured, but we never hear about those.
Given the history of U.S. regime change, which has failed in places like Iraq and in places like Libya, just to name a couple, why would the media have us believe that it might be successful this time in Syria?
Well, it's not just the media. It's the media kind of in cahoots with neoconservative forces and with Clintonites, basically. The hawks in the U.S. establishment won't give up on their regime change project for Syria. And I guess it comes back to what your definition of success is. If the definition of success is just to destabilize, disrupt, and ruin a country, they've actually succeeded in Libya, which, of course, is a failed state now. It's chaotic. But they did manage to overthrow a government and destabilize the whole Libya and actually the spread of terrorism beyond Libya. But if the objective is simply to destroy a government that you consider an enemy, they actually succeeded. And that's the danger,
right?
And that's what we need to really come out and oppose.
Sure, I'm sure it all boils down to how you define this. When you hear that well-intentioned humanitarian arguments for intervention, such as we have heard, to save Syrians from Assad's barrel bombs, how would you respond to these concerns?
People need to just look into the facts. There's a tremendous exaggeration on those scores, and it's following the same pattern that the U.S. does when it prepares to invade another country. They demonize the intended target, and then they create humanitarian causes which are going to justify it. So in the case of Libya, there were accusations that Libyan soldiers were raping women. There were accusations that there was a massacre upcoming. And then later on, after the overthrow of the government, we learned that there was no foundation to those reports. There was the famous case of the babies being taken from incubators, supposedly, in 1990 that led to the Gulf War I. That turned out to be a total fabrication. So we need to be very careful about these. We're not going to bring peace by making more war.
For more on this and the TTIP and other trade deals and other wars, we spoke with Professor Tony Montaro from Philadelphia via Skype Monday. Professor Montaro, thank you for your time. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don. It's great to be with you.
So I guess we'll update our listeners on what's happened in the presidential campaigns over the past week, and also the things that are sort of macro that affect the everything, including certainly the campaigns.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a very bad 2 weeks for Hillary Clinton. And if we take Julian Assange at his word, it can only get worse. And obviously, the Clinton campaign, which I'll just say parenthetically, is the ruling class, the 0.1% party at this point. Their strategy in the face of her deterioration as a credible political force in the country, their tactic and strategy is to talk about Trump. Even to go so far as David Fluff, the kind of manager of the 2008 Barack Obama campaign, was on one of the Sunday talk shows talking about Trump as a psychopath and as a madman. And, you know, the whole corporate media has entered upon what can only be called a psychological op, psychop propaganda campaign to make sure that this election never discusses Hillary Clinton and makes Trump out to be the greatest evil since Hitler. So, you know, looking at that, we're looking at a geography of this current political moment, a geography which has literally excluded the concerns of ordinary working people, concerns that are being raised by, ironically, in almost similar language, Jill Stein and Donald Trump. Both, and this is the irony of the situation, running far to the left of the establishment in the country and of Hillary Clinton. And let me just say one last thing. You know, it has been apparent for some time, and political scientists and commentators and journalists have drawn attention to this fact, that the ruling elite, the 0.1%, the bankers and the war makers and those who are for these trade deals and for austerity and repression at home, they see holding on to the presidency and executive power in the country as a strategic center of power. And they're prepared to throw Congress and the Senate aside, but holding on to the presidency. And this should be very troubling. What that symbolizes should be very troubling to people, because what it says is that we have moved beyond a republic or representative democracy where power finally is in the hands of the representative bodies, the Congress, the Senate, the state legislators, the city councils, where now power is concentrated in the executive. We have thereby moved from a democracy to an authoritarian state. The people do not count. You have, and I put quotes, the right to vote, but the information that you need to make an intelligent vote is not available to you, which means that your vote doesn't mean a damn thing because you don't know the issues and don't know what you're to vote for. And therefore, it's all about propaganda. It's all about marketing. It's all about PR. And it's all about attack upon anyone that threatens the power and authority lodged in the presidency, but representative of this 0.1% that runs this nation.
And, you know, they're constructing a very bizarre narrative. Looking at the historical antecedents, first you have Trump as Hitler. Trump is a racist, yeah. And Trump is supported by the right wing and the extreme right and David Duke and all of that. Then Trump is a Russian agent, which, of course, is an interesting take since the Nazis invaded Russia and tried to destroy it and enslave or murder the people there, and they killed almost 30 million of them. So the solution to that incongruity is essentially they turn around and now say that the leader of the massive alt-right movement, quote-unquote, this new right-wing conspiracy from the Clintons' point of view is Vladimir Putin. And so now you have Hitler and a fascist Stalin basically coming on the scene. And so therefore, the issues that are raised by, say, Donald Trump with respect to employment and all of the issues that he's raising, and also by Jill Stein and others, they don't count. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have to stop Hitler, Trump. And on the other, you can't vote for Stein because you have to stop Hitler, Trump. That means vote for Clinton. It's an interesting rewrite of history and like a remolding of it.
Well, it's classic George Orwell propaganda. This is the state that George Orwell in the book 1984 predicted, where the state has so much power over information and over what people know about their political and economic and social realities, that people are thus diminished as citizens, as agents of active political change in their own society. And this is what we face right now. I think that shaping of discourses, which is a science and an art in and of itself, is so very important to maintaining the power of this small, oligarchic, plutocratic, dictatorial, authoritarian elite. And that's what they are. And the plan is more austerity. And, we're now hearing about the potential collapse of Obamacare, which was predicted. More austerity, no economic growth. Rather than investing in productivity and growth here in the United States, the U.S. Capitalists have decided to shift all the jobs overseas. That's what globalization means. That's what TPP means. That's what NAFTA means. And in return, the people will be given entertainment and distraction and austerity and a worldview that is tailored for them, which says, well, it really isn't that bad. It's so interesting and ironic that African Americans who suffered the most in the Great Recession of 2008, who are still suffering, who lost half of the wealth that they had accumulated in a very brief period between 1970 and 2008, lost half of that wealth and have not regained it. In cities where African Americans are majorities, like Flint and Detroit and Cleveland, Flint, about the water crisis, Detroit, a crumbling school system, a crumbling public sphere where people are living in abject poverty. The economy and everything has collapsed. So, but you tell black people we're making progress because you have a black president, and black people, in spite of the objective conditions of their lives, say to people who take surveys, well, we feel we're doing better than we were 8 years ago, when in fact they're doing worse. Now, the Trump movement, and this is one of the great ambiguities and ironies of our time, the Trump movement has taken the spirit of Occupy Wall Street, the spirit of fighting against inequality, not just in slogans, but in actual policy, has taken that and unhinged and challenged the very foundation of the authoritarian rule of this oligarchic class that we're now being ruled by. This is ironic. The left does not see it. Of course, the liberals don't want to see it. Those who consider them themselves social Democrats, who I believe are people who want socialism but don't want to fully break with liberalism, have been, you know, they are in a state of confusion, sadly.
You mentioned setting the narrative, essentially, you mentioned the ambiguity between the actual policies that have faced black communities over the past 8 years and the perception of it that is widely held, and that certainly relates to it. And it happens in an era where black-owned media has been steadily crushed along with other black assets. And I'm wondering what it is exactly in terms of policy that people would hear if this condition didn't prevail, and if they could hear about actual policy with respect to economics, for example, where you talk about Trump making proposals that would, shrink inequality materially.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's apparent to anyone that wants to see, one of the things that has become apparent to me is that even among the left, and so-called progressive people, what they don't like about Trump is that he doesn't fit their image of what a president of the United States should be. But Hillary fits it better. You know, some people call her the devil we know. Well, she's that kind of familiar figure that those who do not wish to think critically can find comfort in. However, if the debate ever breaks out in this presidential cycle, that needs to happen, the debate over trade policy, the debate over war policy, the debate over austerity, the debate over the condition of black folk living in cities all around this country, if that debate ever breaks out, catastrophic could happen for the elite. They cannot have that debate. They don't want that debate. And therefore, they must constantly focus upon Trump as a neo-fascist, as a madman, and as someone who does not have what they call the temperament and judgment of a president. And therefore, Hillary Clinton, under these conditions, becomes your only possible choice. This is a grave mistake, and especially for the left to repeat the mistake that it made in 2008 with respect to Barack Obama. If we make that, and it seems we are going to make that mistake again, it will set the mass movement back. Because where do you go after you have said that in spite of all of her negatives, vote for Hillary? Does that mean that the left is now in bed with the war makers, those who everybody that looks at this agrees, those forces that are pushing the world towards a major war with major powers that have nuclear weapons? Is that who we want to be in bed with? We have a choice. You know, I think that Jill Stein is a choice that we can make. I think Trump, for many people, is that oppositional force, that protest candidate that is a choice. A message must be sent to the ruling elite that we want jobs, we want peace, we want democracy in this country. We do not want the type of rule that is now in place and is wreaking havoc on the working class and the middle class of this country.
And one of the things that you've been saying over the course of our last few months that we've been talking about this is pointing out the looming possibility of another economic crash or another financial crash. And on the front page of the Financial Times, it seems that that condition may well, materialize sometime soon. It may impact the election. If it does, how do you think it affects people's perceptions about the election, which are currently framed in Trump is the enemy and evil, and so you have to vote for Hillary Clinton, since she's pretty much identified with the past 8 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that given the chaos and manufactured confusion and disorientation, we will probably have the lowest voter turnout percentage-wise in many, many decades, perhaps going back to the 1950s. This election can be decided by two things. One is what will be the next dump of emails by Julian Assange and what they will tell us about Clinton and the way our government functions. The other thing is a economic collapse where the floor falls out from under the economy. Now, as you pointed out, on the front page of the Financial Times, they're talking about global stagnation. Now, global stagnation for people who have not recovered from the last great recession means that they have not recovered from the depression that they're in and will continue to be in that state of depression. Many of those people will not vote. They see, according to the way the press and the media are shaping or designing the discourse, they don't see an option for themselves and they will not vote. The other thing is that if something dramatic happens in the economy, I think it throws the election into profound chaos. That doesn't mean Donald Trump wins. I don't think Donald Trump has many options to winning this election. I think he's aware of that, and I think his campaign is therefore operating almost like a mobilizing mechanism for a part of the working class, and we really don't know how deep and wide his message is getting into the working class. But it is almost like a mobilizing force or mechanism. And therefore, things that he says, like the system is rigged, Hillary Clinton is a puppet being controlled by Wall Street puppet masters, that these trade deals are killing the American working people, that we have to get out of NATO, that we can no longer finance the nuclear presence in Northeast Asia, and all of this stuff is a kind of political education with all of the drawbacks, not just of Trump, but of the white working class itself. But we are seeing potentialities. And, you know, that's what I like to emphasize, the potentiality in this awakening, that it is not black folk, it is not gay folk, it is not Latinos who are the problem. It is the 1% or the 0.1% who run a rigged system, and Hillary Clinton is the political representative of all of that.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting take, because conceding for the sake of argument the characterization of Trump as an enemy of immigrants and, you know, all of that, when he does describe the processes, he describes the immigrants almost as being pawns of the 1% that are being unleashed against labor here. In other words, that they are not self-motivated opponents of the working class here, but manipulated into it. And
that's what NAFTA was designed to do, destroy the agricultural economy of Mexico, ship jobs from here to Mexico where wages are lower. But all of these, for the most part, people coming from Mexico and from Central America to the United States who are undocumented are either the direct victims of NAFTA or the direct victims of American wars of regime change in Central America, be it Nicaragua, earlier Panama, Honduras, and on and on and on, El Salvador. So, you know, when you think about it, the crisis of refugees and of immigrants can be directly taken back to the Clinton administration of the 1990s and the Obama, Hillary Clinton, Republican, Democratic wars of the 2000s. So this is the global crisis. It can be traced right back to the policies primarily of Democratic administrations.
And that same policy was followed in many other places. One glaring example, as I was reminded earlier today, I spoke with David Oxygen in Haiti, was Haiti. The policies that, well, first you had the coup under George Bush in 1991, and then the policies that the Clinton administration pursued towards Haiti ended up doing exactly the same thing to the agricultural sector in Haiti that it did in Mexico, including generating, as you'll recall, the Haitian boat people as refugees from the evisceration, essentially, of the agricultural sector there and the imposition of a dictator.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the refugee issue and the issue of undocumented people throughout the globe, this problem is the result of neoliberal globalization and these trade pacts and the World Trade Organization and the wars that have principally been initiated by the United States. And these wars in the 2000s have mainly been in the Middle East, in Arab countries, which means that implicit in these wars is huge Islamophobia. You see, so while they talk about Trump as the Islamophobe, it is really the ideological rationalization of wars so-called against terrorism, which carry with it a justification that the terrorists are Muslims, and this is, by implication, a war against at least the bad Muslims, whatever that means. And so, you know, we're in a very deep crisis. And I would agree with Jill Stein, and I would agree with Donald Trump on this. We have to completely reverse the foreign policy of the nation, the alliances, especially with the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia in particular, and with the state of Israel. I mean, those things have to be changed immediately if we are to get off this course that could be leading us to a world war.
Professor Montero, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.